It would be inappropriate to have this event without acknowledging and thanking Kim and Amnesty International UK for their incredible, incredible work on the Troy Davis campaign. We collected, as a movement, over 1 million signatures on behalf of Troy Davis, which was remarkable. And Kim had a huge part in that. So just so thankful. So my name is Scott Langley, and I hail from the not-so-great country of the United States. 12 years before I was outside of this prison at Troy Davis's execution, I was attending a vigil for an execution in Texas, where I grew up and lived for 25 years of my life. As you may know, Texas is the capital of executions, not just for the United States, but for much of the world. And 12 years ago, I was standing outside of the prison in Huntsville, Texas, where all the executions happened. And I was just a young college student, never been to a protest before, never been to a vigil, didn't really have a lot of political views. But I did know that George Bush was our governor, and I knew that Texas was executing on a gurney by lethal injection an average of one prisoner each week in the course of my time in Texas. And I went to that prison just to experience what it would be like to stand outside of a prison when the state was taking human life. And when I arrived, I didn't really know what to expect. But as I stood there on that street corner across from this prison, I looked up and noticed that there was a big clock over the door. And in Texas, executions happen at 6 o'clock in the evening. There was just one last night at 6 o'clock in the evening, in fact. And you can watch that minute hand ticking closer and closer to 6 o'clock as you stand there on that corner. And as you're standing there, perhaps there's some other activists, some other people who are concerned, standing with you, holding candles, having prayer, or protesting with signs. And nearby, there's a separate building from the prison where the people who are going to witness the execution will gather. This will be the families of the prisoner, families of the victim, friends of the victim, police officers, the attorneys. These people will gather in this room. And then as that minute hand gets closer and closer to six, those people will walk from one building into those prison doors under the clock. And I stood there watching all this play out in front of me. And it was just in one particular moment at this man's execution in January of 2000, as I stood there, that as the people processed from the building into the prison to watch this execution, the parents of the man being executed, Ken and Lois Robeson, instead of entering that building to watch the state of Texas put to death their son, they came and joined us on the sidewalk and stood with us. And as you sat there watching that minute hand get closer and closer to six, the anxiety, you could feel it building in the crowd. And when 6 o'clock struck, you heard screaming and cries from the mother who knew at that moment her son was being taken from her. And it was in that moment of helplessness and anxiety and horror that I saw face to face a parent as they lost a loved one to state-sanctioned murder. And I knew it was from that moment on I could not let something like that pass that I would see with my own eyes without capturing it with my camera. And I also knew at that moment that the plight of the families with loved ones on death row was something that could not be ignored. A few years later, I felt moved to respond to that in many ways. One was continuing the work of my photography, but the other was to reach out and begin to help the families of those on death row. My wife and I set up a hospitality house near a prison in North Carolina where people were executed by the state on an average of 8 per year. We set up a home where we invited the families of death row prisoners to come and spend time in a place where they had support, they had a free place to stay, food to eat, and someone to listen to so they could tell their stories. And we saw family after family come through our house, only to leave our house and walk across the street to that prison to watch their loved ones being executed. It was a brutal, brutal thing to experience on a monthly basis, or in places like Texas, a weekly basis, knowing that someone is being killed and that we are leaving behind mothers and fathers, sisters, uncles, and brothers as the state kills. So last year, a year ago today, I find myself in Jackson, Georgia, attending the second execution date for Troy Davis with my camera in hand. And this time, I was standing near the family of Troy, his sister Martina, his other sister Kim, his nephew, and other members of the Davis family. But instead of the wailing of tears and the crying that I've experienced at other vigils, this family was very calm and centered. And I knew at that point that they were the strong, I knew all along that they were the stronghold in this movement, that if they could remain strong and calm in this hour of horror, that we had to stand with them in whatever way that meant. And I know that we all have a story from a year ago on where we were and what we were doing and how we felt. And the photos are what I use to tell my story. So I don't necessarily need to talk a lot about what you see here, because you can experience that for yourself. But I think it's also unique for us to also acknowledge how we've individually coped with this loss of Troy Davis, how we've dealt with the tragedy of this murder. And I knew for me, that meant that I needed to do something. And one of that was to get these photos printed and get them out there so that people could see and experience what I experienced at the prison that day. And one of the other things I felt called to do was to organize a group of people to go to our U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., and to take a banner on the stairs of the Supreme Court that said "Stop Executions" on the anniversary of our first execution in 1977. So in January of this year, 14 people, including myself, took a banner on the stairs to say "No more executions, and we remember Troy Davis." We were arrested for that action. It's illegal to protest in front of the Supreme Court. We were held overnight in jail. Five of us did not carry any identification when we did this protest. And when the police took us into custody, they said, "What is your name? You have no ID in your pocket." And five of us responded, "We are Troy Davis." We refused to give our name. We wanted the state, we wanted the Supreme Court to remember the name of Troy Davis. We were taken to trial and found guilty. The court ruled that the First Amendment of freedom of speech in the United States does not apply in all areas. We were convicted, sentenced to community service and fines. Several of us who identified themselves as Troy Davis, eventually their real identities were discovered. We offered up our real names in front of the judge. And we were given these fines and community service, and we refused to accept that. We said, in the face of a state that is willing to take human life, when we know what we are doing is the right thing to do for human rights, we will not be complicit. We will not pay fines. In fact, the work we do to end the death penalty is a service to the community. And several of my co-defendants were sent to jail, including an 80-year-old woman who was given 2 months in Washington, D.C. jail for refusing to cooperate. And I'm still awaiting to understand what my fate will be. I just hope that they're nice to me when I re-enter back into the United States from this trip. I don't trust the courts yet. But I know I'm in good hands here, so you'll help me out if things go wrong. So just a few things to note. I don't want to talk about all these photos because you can see them, as I said. But just to note, you're not supposed to see any of these photos. The state of Georgia did not want these photos to be seen. The state would not allow cameras on the prison grounds of the prison that night unless you're a credentialed journalist with a media outlet. I am not. I am an activist, a freelance activist, and a freelance journalist. But I falsified credentials to get access to the prison grounds with my camera. And the media area where you could be with a credential to take photos was separate from the area where the protesters were. They didn't want the media interacting with the protesters or the family of Troy Davis. But it was at this moment that I found myself in that area with my camera and was able to take some of these photos from that space. And at that moment, at 7 o'clock, when we thought Troy Davis was being executed, this photo on the two women hugging in the bottom center was that moment at 7 o'clock where we thought Troy Davis was being killed. And all hell broke loose. People were screaming, people were crying, police were running around, arresting people. It was a nightmare. But in the chaos of the nightmare, I snuck from the designated media area into the area where the protesters were. And so that from that photo on, all these photos were taken where there were no other journalists around because the state did not want people to see the photos of Martina at the moment of her brother's death or photos of his nephew crying, waiting for the outcome of this. In fact, I met at an Amnesty International conference a young woman who had been in that protest area and had her camera with her to take photos. And the police took notice of this, and they confiscated her camera, deleted all her photos, and never returned her camera to her. I didn't know this until after the fact. But I knew while I was there that I was nervous for my safety, for my freedom, for my camera equipment. These photos could have easily been confiscated. I just feel so blessed that I'm able to bring them here to you, because these photos should not have been seen if the state of Georgia had their way. So it wasn't until 2 days after the execution of Troy Davis that it really sunk in what had happened. I was there in photographer mode, trying to keep it together to make sure that I got what I could. I had to take these photos very inconspicuously. I had to hide my camera. I had to take many of the photos without even looking through my camera because there were so many police around. But when I got home to go through the thousands and thousands of photos I took in Georgia that weekend, I began to look through them and began to relive those moments. When I got to that photo that Cam referred to of Martina sitting in the wheelchair introducing the young woman to Amnesty International representatives, when I got to that moment and realized that the time of the capture of that photo was the exact time that Troy Davis died, I lost it. And for days, I cried. I would wake up in the middle of the night crying. I would have to pull over on the side of the road whenever a news report would come on about Troy Davis and weep. We all know that executions, torture, disappearances, all these things we deal with at Amnesty International are grave, grave injustices. And they traumatize not just the victims, but us as a society. So, as Kim so eloquently stated, when we saw Martina in that moment, that strong moment, she was ill, she was tired, but she was still recruiting new activists for the movement. And that's really what I took away from that experience. I wasn't weeping out of sadness of losing Troy so much. I wasn't weeping so much for the sadness of the family's loss, because I knew they would be strong. I was moved by that moment, knowing that the Troy Davis family was out there encouraging us, motivating us to do what we know is right as human rights advocates and activists. The Davis's strong resilience in the face of injustice and the power of Amnesty's people really made a difference in this case. Everyone stepped up to fight the injustice. We didn't win for Troy that day, but we did win the hearts and minds of people all over this world. And step by step, one step at a time, one person at a time, one case at a time, that's going to make and build the movement. For many of us, Troy was that first step. For many of us, it was just a step in many on this journey. And it's a story that we'll not forget. And as Kim said, the world knows the name of Troy Davis, and we will not forget. Earlier this year, I showed these photos to some students at the most expensive private high school in the state, in the country of the United States. I talked to 100 young women who come from very wealthy families. They all drive very expensive cars. Before I started, I said, raise your hand if you know the name of Troy Davis. All 100 of these young women raised their hand. The world knows the name of Troy Davis. We're here to remember Troy Davis, and we're here on September 21st, 2012, to say that we are still Troy Davis. So thank you very much.